Good morning, members. We don't have a quorum yet.
Good morning, members. We don't have a quorum yet, but Mr. Fabian likes to start his class on time. We do have a few bills in front of us today. We got Representative Nash, Representative Fleck Johnson, Representative Swedzinski. Anybody have any questions or comments for the benefit of the group this morning while we're waiting for one more member? I suppose we can't just ordain someone from the audience to be a member or anything. Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just enjoyed the breakfast that with the townships this morning. A number of us were over there, and Representative Eklund gave a speech. I had to leave early, so I didn't stay for his comments, but I'm sure they're excellent. But it's also just a memory of some of the things we're doing that affect townships, and my guess is that they appreciate helping them do their business at the local level.
That's terrific. Yeah, they're a great organization. Members, I'd like to call the meeting of the Environmental Policy and Finance Committee, Natural Resources and Policy and Finance Committee, to order. We have before us the minutes from February 21st, 2017. Representative Lewick, would you move the minutes, please?
I was so moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor of the minutes as printed, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. With that, we'll begin. Representative Nash. Yeah, it's not boom.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Good morning, Representative Nash.
Sheriff, you
we're planning to lay this bill over. Representative Nash, before us is House File 150, and I move to lay this over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 150, very straightforward bill. I wanted to thank the members on this committee for your co-authorship. Many of you have signed on to this bill. The bill is very straightforward. It's putting or allowing scopes to be put on muzzleloaders. And I have been a muzzleloader hunter for probably the last 30-something years. It is a sport that I dearly love. I take all of my kids. As far as my wife knows, I have 4 muzzleloaders and the 7 muzzleloader guns that I use hunting. I thought that'd be funnier. Some of them are modern inline, some of them are side hammers. I dearly love it. You know, if you stop by my office, you'll see one of the deer that I have taken hanging on my wall. And it was taken with a muzzleloader. It's a fantastic sport. A lot of folks enjoy it because it's sort of after the modern gun season. There you go. It's show and tell day. There's a lot of folks who have been muzzleload hunters for a long time that are beginning to have a little bit of vision problems. You know, you look around, most of us wear glasses, sadly. We're not all optically perfect. And this is all about helping to drive participation, because as an ethical hunter, you want to make sure that you've got a proper sight picture and you're taking that ethical shot. And I have a gentleman in my district who stops me every time he sees me and says, Jim, I'm the grandfather of, I think, 11 now, and he is the grandpa that takes kids hunting. And they all like to muzzleload. He's unable to do so anymore because he feels that he's not able to do that ethical shot because of his vision problems. This solves that. It's a very simple, straightforward bill. Many of our adjacent states allow this. It's about a 50-50 swap. You know, we've got some that do, some that don't. But members, if we are all about driving up the next generation of hunters, I would ask for your support on this bill. And I would stand for questions. I believe there's one testifier.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Mr. Speck.
Good morning.
Please identify yourself for the record and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning, everybody. Tim Spreck representing the interests of the Minnesota Weapons Collectors this morning. Mr. Chair, we're here to speak in favor of this bill. As most of us know who have been here a number of years, this has come before both bodies year after year. We managed to move it forward a little bit year by year, and now it's time to push it across the finish line. This is an important bill. It allows additional participation, additional accuracy. It allows a good, clean kill shot. And the most important thing to remember about this is if you do not choose to use a scope on your muzzleloader, you do not have to. You can still hunt primitive. You can still hunt traditional. But it provides an additional piece of equipment for people who would like to have a scope. And I think we should move this forward. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Member questions? Ms. Becker-Finn, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. Are you worried about losing your old school cred by adding a scope to your muzzleloader?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Becker-Finn, no, I'm not. I even go so far as to make my own Possibles bags. I've got a coonskin cap if I were to be so inclined, but I do not worry about losing, because I can still probably outshoot a lot of folks with my Kentucky long rifle that I built from a kit. So this isn't about me. It's about a lot of the folks that want to take their grandkids hunting. It's about a lot of folks who, you know, I've got a friend, he loves to hunt. He claims himself he can't see the broadside of a barn without his glasses on, and the magnification that comes from a scope is going to help him participate in a sport that we all love. So I appreciate that, and if you'd like to see the Possibles bags, I can bring them in. I'm happy to make you one.
Okay. Representative Becker-Finn, any follow-up?
So just, I'm trying to picture you in a buckskins and a loincloth, but I think I'm not going to.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we should go there today. It's a little early for that.
Representative Hanselman has a question or a comment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more of a process question for you. This is being held over. So as we're getting these traditional game and fish items, is it your intent to be developing a game and fish bill that would run separately, or is it your intent to put these in with the finance bill?
Or both. Representative Hanson, I think what my intention is to definitely have a game and fish bill, and exactly what form that takes in the end, I'm not 100% sure yet, but I would welcome input from members of the committee to see what ideas they have. So, Representative Nash, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. As you know, I've been the chief author of this in the past, and I'm a strong supporter of it as well. Representative Neuberger has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick one, Representative Nash, can you use these muzzleloaders with scopes to shoot geese?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberger, I'm all about the ethical shot, and I don't believe that unless I'm going to hunt with a blunderbuss, which would not have a scope on it, that I would even consider taking a shot on a goose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I would, by the way.
This is a public meeting. Is there anybody here who would like to testify for or against the bill? Your opportunity is now. I don't know if DNR has any comments on Representative Nash's bill. If they'd like to. Okay. I don't. It's if you want.
Good morning.
Yeah. As Representative Swidzinski says, you're in the crosshairs now. So, identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Pat Rivers, Deputy Director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife, and I hope those crosshairs are accurate and perhaps they even have a scope. We're neutral on this bill. We have about 50,000 muzzleloader hunters across the state, and we can manage our deer herd with regulations if the harvest becomes higher with the more efficient scoped muzzleloader.
Thank you. Any questions, anybody? Representative Nash, closing comments on your bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to carry this. Now that you're the chair, I appreciate it. I know that we all share a love for muzzleloading. You know, the gentleman that's in my district is named Ron, and he's very excited about this today, and I want to be able to thank him, thank you on his behalf for laying this over for possible inclusion.
Well, hopefully someday Ron builds a statue to you.
I don't know that I'd go that far.
Okay, okay, with that,
thank you, Chair.
With that, members, we'll lay the bill over. Okay. Next, we have Representative Clark Johnson, House File 333.
Gluck Johnson and I, Representative Johnson and I, graduated from the same high school together at different times.
At different times.
Yeah.
I'm a little older and therefore a little wiser.
Okay, I think we'll move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. This bill came to me as a result of constituent contact.
Representative Johnson, I'll move your bill to lay this over, okay? Pardon me for interrupting.
This happened during hunting season, and this is a gentleman on active duty who returned to live in Minnesota, and he got his driver's license, and he got that yellow sheet of paper and tried to use that to get his hunting license, and realized that was not sufficient. And so I thought, well, you know, and his point was, by the way, he would be here today, but he's working today, and he just can't be here. He's very interested in this. And we talked about it, and we communicated about it, and basically the thought was, you can use that yellow sheet of paper to drive your automobile to the deer stand or drive your truck to the deer stand, but you can't then proceed and hunt. And it just didn't seem logical to us. And so that's the genesis of this bill. So then, currently law requires a current Minnesota driver's license, and the language added in the bill would add a current temporary Minnesota driver's license consisting of the receipt and the copy of the application form to demonstrate that they're a resident.
Thank you. It's a good idea. Members, questions? Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, how does the state determine the 60 days for residency?
Representative Johnson.
I'd like to know that. Perhaps the DNR could respond to that.
Mr. Meyer, Commissioner Meyer, come down, please. Please identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. So the question you asked was, how does the state determine the 60 days of residency?
I believe that's the question, Representative Beckman. Is that correct?
Yeah, that would be determined once you can prove, I believe, Mr. Michaels can correct me if I'm wrong, but once you determine your new address or location and apply for that driver's license, would establish the time period for that. The issue we have is the piece of paper doesn't prove that you're a resident. So with our system, it's built upon a driver's license number where we track individuals and we make sure that they're current on their child support and all the federal issues, and that their violations are tracked as well. So if this bill were to go into law, a person could apply for a license, go buy a hunting license, and we would not know if they were in violation of Game and Fish or revocations on their record from another state perhaps, or if they were in arrears of their child payment dollars. So that person would be able to get a license, hunt for that season, create a record. They could then use that one record that we don't have any verification on in subsequent years to obtain licenses potentially illegally or in violation of Game and Fish law. So it's not perfect. The piece of paper is the way the system runs, but current law says you have to have a driver's license, and without that driver's license number and that record established within our database, we cannot track people and tell if they're in violation of the law or not.
Commissioner Meyer, any idea of how many people are impacted by the situation that Representative Johnson is trying to address in this bill?
Mr. Chair, I typically get one or two calls a year, if that, on the issue. The issue dealing with active military, if that active military person has a Minnesota driver's license, they're fine. A lot of people who are in the military active, for example, in Arizona, will establish a residency in Arizona because you never have to change or you never have to renew your driver's license, so then you have a lifetime Arizona driver's license. And what happens sometimes is when these people come in to us and say they're active military and a resident in Minnesota, we do a little research in it, and most times it seems that they have dual residency. They claim residency in Colorado or Arizona for hunting or fishing privileges, perhaps, and they want to come back to Minnesota and have a resident license as well. So that's another issue we have to make sure we're dealing with and making sure that people are staying in the constraints of the law as well. It's not a perfect system, but it's a system that works for us right now.
Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. My misunderstanding, if, for example, I typically buy a variety of hunting and trapping and fishing licenses every year, if I I don't know how I'd do this, but I guess if I somehow got behind on my child support and I went to buy a new trapping license for next year, then I would be refused at the Farm Island store there right next to me because your database would catch that. I don't know. I'm just curious.
Mr. Meyer. Mr. Chairman, let me bring up Steve Michaels on that, but that is a violation of federal law. That's why we ask for Social Security numbers. We're tracking Social Security numbers within our database to make sure people are in compliance. And Mr. Michaels, the director of our licensing division, can answer more to
that. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Steve Michaels, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I am the Electronic Licensing System Program Director.
Proceed.
I believe the question was on child support issues.
Yes. How would that licensing outlet there, would something come back in the computer that says, oh, they alert, even though my kids are over 21, they've got their own kids and I got grandkids, we're not behind on child support or anything like that. But would that come back through and they would be refused the license?
Chair, Mr. Michaels. Representative, yes. The way it works, and I'm not real familiar with the whole background on child support issues, but if you meet certain requirements of not paying your support, we get a court order from a judge that says deny a person their access to buy licenses. We'll then go into the system, identify that person, and do that into the system. So if you would go to the agent, yes, he would be denied.
Okay. Observer Lurick. Area, and I'll just make this comment as one who, I probably had a driver's license from at least six different states in my time in the military, and in almost all cases, those states could care less where your residency was. If you were physically in the state more than 30 days or 45 days, you would get their driver's license completely independent of where your permanent residency is. So we got to be cautious about making the assumption, particularly with military people, that because they're carrying a driver's license from California, that they are not permanent residents of someplace else, because I can just tell you, at least six different driver's licenses, and some of my contemporaries weren't quick enough to do that, and believe me, in some places it's a stiff fine. And you can't get away from it because you've got a sticker on your car that identifies you as a military person to park on the base. So that's the first thing that the local people do is they stop and check your license and casually ask you how long you've been stationed where you're at. And obviously you can't lie about that because that's all public record. So want to be cautious about making assumptions about who's carrying what driver's license and how that applies to residency with the active duty military people.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Meyer, can an undocumented person who's a resident get a hunting license or a fishing license?
Commissioner Meyer, Mr. Michael.
Chair, Representative, I'm not quite sure that any non-resident can get a hunting or fishing license. Yeah, if you're a resident, you would have to have a driver's license or an ID. Not sure if that answers your question.
Or an ID.
Representative Hansen.
Or an ID.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Your other testifier can answer this. The Social Security number component I haven't purchased a license in a while. Is that mandatory? What if if you don't give them your Social Security number, do you not get a license?
Mr. Michaels.
Yes, the Social Security number is required by federal and state law. There are exceptions, say like the Amish.
Representative Berger.
Thank you for your answer. Sometime offline, would you please email me the reference to the federal law that gives the DNR that ability to do that? I would be interested to read that. Thank you.
Mr. Michaels?
Chair. Representative, yes. We'll get that.
Okay. Representative Johnson-Bryan. Okay.
Question is answered.
That was a simple bill.
Yeah.
How do we establish, I mean, how do we establish residency to vote? Kind of a rhetorical question, I guess, but any other questions? Representative Johnson, it appears to me that maybe there's a little bit of work to do here. I'm not exactly sure where the bill's at, but I think that we can have some offline discussions about exactly what to do and encourage you to work with committee members and DNR to get to a good place here with that. Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, thank you for hearing this. My constituent was concerned not really for himself because he had a way through his paperwork with the military to secure the resident license, but he just thought it bothered him because he in his words, I can't quote it directly, but he was talking about how, you know, I really wanted to enjoy my family out hunting. You know, that's what we talk a lot about. And he saw this as an impediment, and just the logic of it, it is interesting that you can drive a car with that document and all that's entailed there and the risk that's involved with that, but you can't hunt. The problems that are resolving that relate to the child support and that sort of thing are significant. I acknowledge that, so you're right, it needs a little work. But thank you for hearing the bill.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for understanding the complexity of this issue. Obviously, the department wants to do whatever we can to remove or reduce barriers for getting people outdoors, so we'll be working with Representative Clark and the committee to see if there's a possible solution.
Or Representative Johnson.
Representative Johnson.
Just if you work with me.
Please. Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'll lay House File 333 over, and we'll for possible inclusion at a later time. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Okay. Representative Swiedzinski, we have House File 766 before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 766 before the Environment Committee for possible inclusion and a future omnibus bill. We do have an A1 amendment that I would like to move to get the bill in the shape, and I'd like to move that. That amendment simply, it kind of reflects some of the conversations we've had with the agency, kind of regarding some of the final language within that section of the bill, and we'd like to change it up to get it right, to address some of those concerns and get in the shape we'd like.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Swiedzinski. Members, we have the A1 amendment before us. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. We now have House File 766 in the form that the author would like. Proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 766's main goal is to truly increase transparency and give local governments voice when it comes to particularly impaired waters. You know, in the first section of the bill, if you'll turn, the amended portion of subsection 6 in House File 766, but the amendment really moves the bill to allow over 60 days rather than 30 for public comment on proposed impairments, and it allows entities affected to challenges to be raised if they're seriously concerned about proposed impairments, such as failure to reflect recent infrastructure improvements. So that really deals with some dates and how far back they look and then what they look at. And that portion is really to focus on transparency. And the second half of the bill really works on, you know, creating a stronger voice for those affected cities. And that allows more time before the public notice goes out. So it gives over 30 days for them to review so that they can maybe talk to their staff before we even come before the city council so that they can prepare and then allow all parties additional 30 days afterwards to raise questions about those proposed changes to the impaired waters. I have Bob Stark, the city staff with the city of Red Wing, here to comment and testify before you. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Stark.
Thank you.
Would you please identify yourself for the record and who you represent and proceed with your testimony?
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify in favor of the amended House File 766. My name is Bob Stark. I'm the environmental engineer and the deputy director of public works for the city of Red Wing. My responsibilities include overseeing the operations of our facilities, capital projects, and operations for our city's water, wastewater, and stormwater utilities. I also serve on the executive committee for the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board, which is a statewide organization of wastewater personnel, and on the Environmental and Energy Committee for the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. These positions provide me with a perspective of the challenges faced not only by the city of Red Wing, but by cities throughout the state. Wastewater treatment is one of the most essential services that a local government provides. It's important to me and to the members of my team that the wastewater from that we release to the Mississippi rivers is clean. And this river is very important to our city. It's where we fish. It's where we swim. Some cities in Minnesota, as you're aware, pull their drinking water from these rivers. Our wastewater permits, which are formerly known as NPDES permits, have a significant impact on our cities, including short, long-term effects on municipal budgets, on our ratepayers, social and economic development, and on the environment. Changes to those permits may require facility upgrades that can cost millions of dollars. Although the state may help with paying some of these upgrades, most of these cities would still be paying a significant portion of the cost. I think it's critical to note that we as a city and myself personally are not opposed to providing clean water. That's my passion. My whole career has been based on that. Our mayors and our city councils and managers have heavy workloads and diverse responsibilities. The significance of wastewater permit changes don't come to their attention until they receive a draft permit and a fact sheet from the agency, or when it's published for public notice and comment. These permits are technical and comprehensive documents. The NPDES permit for our treatment plant is over 50 pages in length. In many cases, engineering, financial, and legal consulting may be beneficial to the city to determine the full impact of the proposed permit. Therefore, it's important that city policymakers have adequate time to analyze the draft permits and to understand the short and long-term impacts, and to ensure that the permit conditions are scientifically and technically sound, lawful, and reasonable. This time constraint is especially apparent in smaller cities where the council may meet only one or two times a month. Given the serious impact that permit changes can have on communities, we believe that extending the pre-notice and comment periods as set forth in the bill is the most effective and practical way to ensure that local governments, or local government and policymakers can be engaged. Similarly, we would ask that more time be given to comment on the impaired waters list as set forth in this bill. The regulatory effect of declaring a water body impaired is significant. During the 2016 impaired waters listing process, MESRB and several of our members found technical flaws regarding several impairments and determinations. For a few of our municipal permittees, the 30 days was not enough time to review and comment on the MPCA's data and analysis. We were pleased that the MPCA granted the request to extend the public comment period to 60 days, but we'd like to see that change be made permanent because even requesting this extension takes time and money. We also want clarification that a contested case hearing can be brought. Right now, when the MPC sends out a permit or a plan known as a TMDL, the agency clearly states that you can bring a contested case hearing. However, when the draft list of impaired waters is sent out, there's no such notice of that right, and we'd like to see that clarified. We also believe that when substantial investments have been made and pollutants have been reduced, that should be reflected in the impaired water list. I'm proud of the work that we do ensuring that Minnesota's waters are clean. We will continue to take the steps that are required to ensure that our water is clean. What we're asking of the legislature is to add some transparency by increasing the time allowed for comment on these issues. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Stark, and thank you for the good work that you do and how you and your community care about the environment. It's
thank you.
Always a pleasure to hear people like you before our committee.
Thank you.
Next, we have Ms. Wafel. Would you please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, my name is Elizabeth Wafel, and I'm an attorney with Flaherty & Hood. I'm appearing on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, an organization with approximately 88 cities across the state of Minnesota. And I just wanted to just briefly comment on the bill. We have tried to address some of the concerns that were raised at the Senate hearing. Unfortunately, we haven't, I don't know if we've addressed all concerns because we have not spoken with the MPCA about these. I also wanted to comment on the second portion of the bill. This is really focused on giving the policymakers more time to comment with respect to the what is called the NPDES permit. It's putting in time sort of both before and after. Mr. Stark said, really these issues don't come into focus until we get that draft bill for our policymakers, like our city councils and mayors, especially for towns that only meet, you know, every 30 days. It's really important that they have the time to focus on those issues. So that's really what we're trying to do with that aspect of the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for these folks? Next, I'd like to have Ms. Gauthier come down here from the Pollution Control Agency.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Greta Gauthier from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 766 as amended. I wanted to just say that the A1 amendment takes care of a couple of problems that we had with the bill as it was introduced, but it also leaves a couple problems remaining that I wanted to highlight for the committee. Because you have a lot of new members, Mr. Chair, I wanted to just speak for 30 seconds about how we make the impaired waters list. So the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act, requires every state to make a make an impaired waters list. And we update the list every 2 years, as all states are required to do. We work very closely with local partners throughout the process of making the list. Local partners actually help us collect and do collect the data for us, whether it's SWCDs, watershed districts, even some of our larger cities are able to provide us with data that we use to make the impaired waters list. These partners who helped collect the data also help us review the data to make sure that we're going the right way. We hold informational hearings for at least a month all over the state before we post the draft list for comment. Then we post the list, and we notify 400-plus entities statewide. And then we any of them can ask for an extension to comment for longer than 30 days. We always provide extra time. But here's the most important fact about this process that I wanted to highlight. For a city, whether or not the river or lake or stream that their wastewater treatment plant discharges to is officially listed as impaired or not impaired, it doesn't have any bearing on the city's permit limits for their wastewater treatment plant. So permit requirements are based on what the data show is the quality of that receiving water, we call it in our lingo, which is the water that receives the effluent from the wastewater treatment plant. It's not whether the receiving water is impaired or not. So we work really carefully to review facility and receiving water quality data to develop permit requirements, and we make sure, because under the total maximum daily load TMDL process, no city ever has to do more than their fair share. So if a city's share has been determined to be 5% of whatever that pollution load is in that river, for example, before that river is listed as impaired, and the river is listed as impaired, the city's share is still 5%. The impairment doesn't have an impact on that. So it seems to us like there's kind of a myth out there that the impaired waters list and a city's wastewater permit, that the impaired list has some impact on that permit. So there's kind of this feeling that if you're a city and your receiving water is designated impaired, then you're going to have more costs and more requirements and so forth. And then there's also this flip side of this kind of myth that if you're a city and your receiving water is not impaired, you're not going to have any requirements in your permit. And it just, both of those myths are just not true. So I'm just trying to kind of put that out there because it's not something we talk about very much, and you've got a lot of new members on your committee, Mr. Chairman. So with that, to the bill as amended, our first concern is on lines 110 and 111 with the statutory standing for challenging the impairment decision. So the impaired waters list is a measure of whether the lake or the river or the stream meets the water quality standards or does not meet them. And, of course, we need to make sure they meet them so that that water is fishable, swimmable, drinkable. So even if some sources of pollution coming into that water were reduced, if other sources are not also reduced sufficiently, the water body may still not meet the water quality standards, and then the water body is still impaired. So the Clean Water Act and our state rules require us to consider all relevant and available data when we make an impairment decision. It's already our practice to consider recent pollution reductions when making a listing determination. So I believe the amendment still requires us to do that. On line 1.11, we already do that. This goes to the emphasis we place on making sure that the data we rely on for listing are representative of the conditions in the water body. The Clean Water Act, we are compelled by the Clean Water Act to consider the measured conditions in the water body itself and not the investment in infrastructure or the reduction that one source of pollution into the river is making. So a second concern is that on lines 110 and 111, again, is that this might cause confusion and uncertainty. So, for example, we don't know on line 111, you know, from an implementation standpoint, what does significant mean? What does documented mean? Who documents it? What does that documentation have to be? Who gets to decide? So it's still not clear whether someone could petition before. The other problem is that we don't have the final say on the impaired water list. The impaired water list final decision is made by EPA. So if there was a contested case hearing before it's final, then that gets confusing because it's not final and could theoretically be changed. So then you've got two different decision processes going at the same time. And that, we think that could be confusing and create uncertainty. We also feel that basically from line 1.7 after Clean Water Act to the very end, if you're really trying to extend the comment period in Section 1, then you don't need everything after Clean Water Act until the end. And we feel that though that language is unnecessary because the public comment period already allows people to challenge our draft impairment waters list. We regularly make changes to the draft based on the public comments we do receive. Challengers can also appeal to the EPA after the list is submitted to EPA for approval. So I guess we don't really understand the rest of the language, what is the problem that it's trying to fix, because it seems redundant to us. Our agency is governed by 229 state statutes right now, and so if it is redundant of what's already out there, we don't understand the need to have us governed by 230 state statutes and regulations. So redundancy is kind of the hallmark of inefficiency, so we just have to say that. We feel it's redundant. Our third concern is on the second page of the bill that was not amended in the delete all, the A1 amendment. So The concern here is not that cities, we don't want cities to have more time. We certainly want to work with cities to ensure that they have a strong understanding of the permitting conditions and that they can work with us, engage with us, talk with us. We're very open to that. But the commissioner is concerned because of the 150-day permitting efficiency law that was enacted in 2011 by the legislature, and the governor also has us under an executive order for the same purposes, that our permits are supposed to be done in 150 days. And we have worked very hard and have been systematically decreasing our bureaucratic processes since 2011. So we feel like this bill, from a larger standpoint, is going in the opposite direction because it's adding 60 days that we are required to add to a limited time of 150. And so Subdivision 3 adds 30 days, and Subdivision 4 adds another 30 days. So, Mr. Chairman, it's just we want to work toward the 150 and do permitting efficiency, and we also understand the city's concern here. But I guess I want for your new members to understand that the legislature set that 150 deadline for us, and so if the legislature wants us to put 60 days onto that, then we just need to make sure that everybody's aware. We do work with communities in advance, and I can have someone talk to more about that, and we have never denied an extension for a permit. So, Mr. Chairman, right now, in its current form, we oppose this bill because we feel parts of it are redundant to current law and therefore not necessary, and also because it does impact our overall 150-day limit for permitting efficiency, and I know the legislature is very concerned about permitting efficiency. And it also, we feel, helps kind of perpetuate this myth that the impaired waters list somehow is driving the municipal permit requirements when that's not the case. So I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. Just a quick question. You say there's two, I think you said 239 statutes that regulate MPCA?
Mr. Chairman, the count I've seen is 229.
229, excuse me. And you didn't want it to go to 230. So does that, does that mean that you're going to bring some ideas to this committee for getting rid of some of those statutes? That's rhetorical. Representative Hansen, you are on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, this House File 766 looks similar to a lot of bills that I think we've seen in the recent past, and I'm guessing we're going to see in the future. It looks like it sets up a perpetual process machine to never get to a decision, and actually adds cost because every draft proposal, every draft impairment is going to be challenged on and on and on. And, you know, Minnesota's waters are impaired. We have impaired waters. The science shows that, and we need to be cleaning that up. And there's a variety of impairments. So on the surface, it sounds good, you know, adding additional public comment, but we have public comment processes right now. It's just this looks like, particularly on that clause from 1.7 to 1.11, there'll never be an impairment designation again because it'll the lawyers will be happily involved in this churning away on process forever and ever and never getting to a determination. So would we need, Ms. Gauthier, we're going to need additional legal funds for just responding to this onslaught of arbitration dealing with these impairment determinations? Do you have the staff to do this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hansen, I believe the fiscal note on this bill is completed. I know we have completed it. I don't know if it has been filed back at MMB and posted for the legislature, but I believe it is. However, the fiscal note has changed significantly with the A1 amendment today. I guess I would need to go back and get an estimate. I don't have that information right in front of me, but I will tell you that our lawyers have their hands full right now, so I would imagine we might need additional help if we did get numerous petitions for contested case hearings on the draft impaired waters lease.
Representative Hansen. Representative Wardenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen's characterizing what's going on as perpetual process machine is unfortunately seems to be correct. But I think underneath that is the issue of cost of wastewater treatment systems. And people just, oh my gosh, they're costly. So instead of addressing the underlying question, which is the cost and how we may need to, or not may, we absolutely should look at how we can either at the state do a better job at helping with those costs or having the university help us with better systems, which we have the civil engineering department at the University of Minnesota to die for. They are really good. Or both. So I think that we need to look at the underlying issue here. And I say that as somebody who drinks the water that you are producing out of these wastewater treatment systems. But it's not just me. It's all the folks who live in St. Cloud and all the folks who live in Minneapolis and St. Paul and a lot of suburbs. We all drink that water. So we have an interest in making sure that your wastewater treatment systems are fine and helping you make sure that they're fine. So I don't think we're on a collision course here, but I think we need to understand each other's perspectives. Mine is drinking water clean. Now, I know yesterday I asked Scottie if she would give us a map of the wastewater treatment systems and the industrial systems that discharge into the upper Mississippi. And I would ask if you would send that to the committee so the committee could see that map, because we're not just talking about, we're talking about at least 20% of Minnesota's population that drinks that water, at least 20%. And I don't think that's a number that, that's not a speculative number. How much over that might be speculative. So a million people, 20% of our population. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think we should be looking at other ways to help cities with their wastewater treatment system. That is the underlying issue here. Instead of gumming up the works with process and the perpetual process machine, let's be problem solving. I'm good for that.
Thank you, Representative Wardenius. I'm game for problem solving too. And when I listen to people like Mr. Stark, in his testimony, I hear the frustration. I'm familiar with the costs. I also know that people like Mr. Stark and the city of Red Wing care about the water. And we don't seem to be able to move off of this. This is an ongoing issue that's been before the legislature for a long period of time. And quite frankly, the frustration that a lot of people express about the permitting process and what's going on at the MPCA is quite disturbing to me. And we need to figure out ways to work with local communities in a more proactive way rather than in a reactive way by a bill that's being brought forward to the legislature. Because this doesn't just fall out of the sky, members. These things don't just, you know, somebody's not just laying around in a room somewhere dreaming up these ideas. These are real concerns for real people who really care about what's going on in their cities and the water that's being impacted. And then we seem to have an agency that is tone deaf to that. And we need to be able to move on from this stuff. Representative Wardenius, I agree with you. We need to solve problems. But I don't see how the agency is solving problems. Quite frankly, I see them creating problems by not working with people like Mr. Stark and the city of Red Wing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This really isn't directly to the bill, but Ms. Gauthier, you used the term drinkable when you were talking about open waters. Which open waters in the state of Minnesota do you suggest I go out and drink?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman, I am sorry, I don't understand the question. Could you please rephrase it?
Representative Torkelson.
You used the term fishable and drinkable when talking about open waters. Which open waters in the state of Minnesota do you suggest I take my cup out, dip into the water, and drink it?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that information with me right now, but fishable, drinkable, and swimmable are the three uses of water in this country that the EPA says Americans have a right to do. So not all of our waters are fishable, swimmable, and drinkable. In fact, 40% of the waters in our state are not. But there are some that are very clean. I don't know where exactly which those are, but I can get that for you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Torkelson.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Perhaps you've never heard of Giardia. I don't know if you've ever drank the water in the boundary waters, but if you drink it, you can get very, very sick. Mm-hmm. Not because those waters aren't pristine. They are pristine, but they are not drinkable, and they never will be.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Representative Swierczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of want to respond. I think that it's been characterized that this bill is really out there to gum up the works, so to speak, and that word's been used. When you talk to the city managers and really the uniqueness of city government, I think, is at play when it comes to these dates. Ms. Gauthier has mentioned that they've always done the extension when requested. But I think when you have set in stone 60 days, I think it really does is gives a bit of certainty. As the cities that may not meet, they may meet just once a month. And let's say they would get notice on the 14th. They had their meeting on the 13th. 1 month goes by. They maybe have not met until the next day when they would have to, the first thing they'd have to do out of the gate is request an extension. I think those things are important, and just realizing, we have city councils that don't necessarily meet every week or every 2 weeks or maybe just once a month. And I think having an open process when it comes to impaired waters, because guess what? The cities around the state feel that it does make a difference when it comes to impaired waters and their ability for permits. Whether or not the body says, I appreciate the agency waiting till today to share some of these concerns with me before the committee upon this bill. We look forward to potentially working with her if there's some potential other changes they'd like. But I do believe there is a trend when it comes to dealing with this. Representative Wagenius mentioned the costs and looking at the technology, and sometimes that's the concern, is does the technology actually work to react to and when it comes to small cities and towns and their ability to afford those things. And I think having an open process of transparency and allowing contested case hearings are an important step when it comes to just addressing these issues facing our state. And I'd appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. I do have a question as well. Mr. Stark, I'll probably call you back a little bit later. Not right now, but I just want to know, what is the process that your city needs to go through for an extension for an extension from the 30 days? But I want to get to other members' questions first. Representative Luick.
Actually, this is not necessarily a question, but more of a comment on my understanding is that MPCA emphatically grants every extension asked for. So that comes back to the small cities and how they operate. And the largest city in my district has got about 2,500 people, and some of them are down as low as 75 people. So some of those cities, councils, they meet once a month. The bulk of them, and I'm talking like 14 cities in my district that are in that range, the bulk of them meet twice a month. When we talk about gumming up the works, we probably need to understand that that small group of people that are not on a full-time wage, like our folks at MPC are volunteers with maybe a per diem if they meet outside of the city limits at some conference, they've got a police force. They're obviously running a sanitary district within their city. Some of them have a public utilities commission that provides electricity for that city. They've got zoning requirements. So even when they meet twice a month, their plate is full. And they'll be set up so that first Monday is of the month is XYZ. They do that work. Third Monday of the month is the rest of it. So this kind of offhand comment about drumming the works up, these people are volunteers generally. They've all got full-time jobs. They do this work in the evenings. And so adding another 30 days to something they're going to get automatically anyway seems to me would reduce MPCA's load on evaluating whether they're going to approve the extension, and the folks at the other end who have got a lot better things to do than sit down and make a public decision that they're going to ask for an extension. Now, this business of gumming up the works, I'm frankly getting a little impatient with those kind of accusations, because I tell you, there's another world out there that doesn't have 300,000 or 400,000 people in those cities. They've got 80, 90, they've got 150 people around those cities. In fact, it gets sometimes half the residents leave when it's time to hold an election, because it's whose turn is it to do the work of taking care of that community? So, I mean, simple little thing like the 60-day time period, so these people have got plenty of time to put that on their plate and deal with it while they're doing all the other things for the community. I mean, it, to me, this coming up is an insult to those people out there.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. Reminds me somewhat of Representative Thomas, or Senator Thomasoni's comments the other night. Representative Ubum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is a little bit of a comment, too. You know, this is a relatively simple bill. The additional time needed, if the MPCA was wanted to act in good faith here with the cities as a true partner, I would think that this wouldn't be any problem whatsoever. It's really important to understand, and Representative Lewick mentioned this, that when a city council first gets this draft notice, and if you're a small city council, the first thing you do is you go to your engineering firm. Well, small cities don't have a city engineer. They're outsourcing that. So it's not like Bloomington, where you might have three or four city engineers. You have to go to your consulting engineer that you're paying time for and everything else. And so it's a time-consuming process. It just doesn't happen in 30 days. And to have this in statute at 60, this shouldn't be a big deal. This is partnering with the cities so we can enable to the cities and the MPCA to sit down and reasonably discuss this and give these small cities time to react because they need it. They don't have a staff that they can turn to on a moment's notice and get the answers they need. Thank you.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm not really hung up on the 60 days as long as everybody in the process realizes that that means that things are going to take longer, because I've heard a lot in this committee about how long the process takes and how burdensome that is and how nobody has certainty. And so that's not really where I take issue. My concern, and maybe I'm new, but maybe there's a different definition of draft that we use here, but to me a draft means that it isn't final. And so when we talk about being reactive versus proactive, I'm having trouble figuring out why we would want a contested case hearing on a draft during the public comment period before our cities and the MPCA have had time to work together. Because my understanding of the process, and maybe the MPCA can clarify this, but my understanding is that you would be working with the local areas and the watersheds to gather the information, so they'd be aware of that. and, you know, it would be down the road that you would then have the draft, and then you'd have the public comment period, and then you would work on the final list. And it, if you still, through that whole process of working together, disagree, it makes sense to me that that is when you would have the contested case hearing, because you don't even really know if you disagree yet, if you're taking this to the Court of Appeals during the draft process. So maybe you could clarify if that is truly the process.
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Chair. You know, this is one of those things. We'd like to work on some of this language with the MPCA. Our original version did have the word final in it. They didn't like it, as what I heard at the Senate hearing, but it would be a lot easier to come up with a great way to make this language work a little better if we could sit down with the MPCA and work the language out. You know, the exact time at which it would happen, you know, I think that, these are some technical challenges with the language that we can work on. But cities are concerned. You know, these issues came up during this last round of the draft impaired waters list, and we're starting to see concerns, and some of them are just coming into focus about other impacts that ending up on that draft impaired waters list can have. It does have an impact in terms of where your TMDLs show up. There are some permits that we are seeing, and you know, again, it's been very recent that this has happened the last couple of weeks. I believe it was Delano that had some challenges down at the EPA because their waters ended up on the draft impaired list. We'd like to talk through some of this stuff with the MPCA and get a language solution on this bill. So is the language perfect? No, but we need to be able to sit down and work out some of those issues. But it does matter to a city when they end up on the impaired waters list. And so should it be final, should not be final? We pulled that language out because we thought that was what was causing the MPCA, you know, sort of a stomach ache. And if that's not what is causing, let's sit down and let's discuss the language of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Wayful. Representative Becker-Finn.
I just wanted to clarify that it isn't really a technical nitpicky thing whether you're allowing it to contested case hearing during a draft period. You know, on a draft means it's not final. and I hear what you're saying, that it may cause concern in other ways to end up on a draft list. But then we need to do education about what draft is versus final. Because it isn't a tiny thing about whether you're allowing a contested case hearing could potentially be a big deal that would gum up the works. I mean, that's what the court process does if we're talking about getting things done quickly. So I just, also the MPCA is here. I don't know what the difficulty is in sitting down to work out those things if everybody is here right now. So might want to look into that. Thanks.
Ms. Wayful.
Yes, sorry. I have made repeated offers to sit down with the MPCA and discuss the language of this bill, and to date, those offers have been declined.
Really?
Yes.
I have a hard time keeping my poker face. Who do we have next here? Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Luke, who brought up my phrase about gumming up the works, I don't have any problem with 60 days. That's fine with me. And the solution there would be to say 60 days up front and 180 days at the end to process the permit. So that solves easily. But far more articulately than I can do, Representative Becker-Finn defined the issue on between draft and final. I could not say it better than she did. So that is the problem with this language. But back to the cost issue, Representative Swierczynski, I am not in any way saying that I want your communities to absorb more cost. Yesterday, I asked PCA if they could look at, again, how we allocate cost. Should the state take over more costs of small wastewater treatment systems? Because that is the fundamental issue.
when we're looking at Brinkable, which is what I'm looking at, does my city have to spend more money to clean up pharmaceuticals in particular that are coming from wastewater treatment systems into our drinking water systems? Because we certainly don't want our children to be drinking somebody else's prescription. So that's where you get Drinkable in. It's preventing things that should not be in the waters from getting into the waters. So that's the concern of folks who drink this water. So I think the 60 days does not seem to be the sticking point here. I think there are other issues that we need to talk about, and I still want us to talk about costs because I think that's the underlying issue here.
Thank you. Representative Swedzinski, comment?
Well, you know, I think, you know, the reason we're here is because there's an entity, whether it be the Coalition of Cities, whether it be individual cities, feel that the current process, that their voices are not necessarily being heard. And, you know, we are an elected body. City councils are elected bodies. They have a certain amount of responsibility to their voters and to their people whom they represent. And, you know, it's, when it comes to conversations and sitting down and coming up with solutions, you know, are we all on the same level? Are we, you know, is our opinion, is our comment weighted equally? Or does it just a matter how many folks happen to point and click on a website to let my voice be heard, and then that carries greater weight than maybe mine, who's directly affected by it? And, you know, I think there's some concern about those things and the potential for how that moves forward. And, you know, this bill wouldn't be here if there was not concerns by folks that live in other parts of the state and that don't necessarily. And that's what this bill, I hope, does, is increase transparency within the agency, but also get after issues. I mean, you know, I've heard a few stories in my short time here that regardless of what's in law, we have certain agencies that may go above and beyond the law when it comes to requirements on business and requirements on individuals, when it comes to the potential for the receiving of a permit in doing testing that's not in law, when it comes to potential air quality or water quality, that maybe have no basis in law. And it's something that they say, well, this will just help make it easier when it comes to an open meeting that we may have. When it comes to your sales pitch to the public and to us, when it comes to the possible permit that we'd like to give you. And sometimes just those tests and those extra things that are asked of business and individuals cost millions of dollars that aren't in statute. And when we have things that are in statute and we're trying to address those on behalf of cities, on behalf of businesses and individuals, we need to hear those, and I think this bill moves in that direction. You know, I understand that I think that was Representative Fabian's bill a number of years back that was brought up about the 150 days in the permitting. You know, that bill moved forward for a particular reason. We felt that that was needed at that time. And I think Representative David says it oftentimes the best. Don't always expect me to be consistent. And, you know, we try to put out fires when they arise, and that's what this bill is trying to do.
Thank you, Representative Swedzinski. And to your point about local voices not being heard, members, if there's any, I mean, this is really telling. This is a quote from PCA spokesman that's in this morning's Duluth News Tribune. Based on more than 1,000 public comments on the draft permit, it appears that U.S. Steel is out of alignment with the majority of commenters who want to ensure standards are met through the permitting process. And our local voices aren't being heard. And people can make public comments. They could live in Europe or in Tennessee or California or someplace else, but the people who live in Red Wing are not being heard. We're in a bad place, members. Next on the list is Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question, but I just want to just make an observation from yesterday and today. I think it challenges this committee. We live in a state that has wide disparities. You know, I listened to Representative Lurk talk about
small cities up in your district, but I also listen to my colleague from Minneapolis who represents a lot of poverty in the city. I wonder how much public comment they have access to as well on Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. And so the goal really, I think, has to be somehow we have to come together and really respect that difference. And I think it's a particular and interesting challenge for Minnesota. I happen to represent a district that is urban. There's a small urban area of Mankato, but it's also very rural. And so I kind of live this a lot in trying to balance that. But I guess that's just a comment. I just hope that we can really respect each other and try to work with each other and make sure that the needs of these small cities are being heard by all of us, but also the needs of the people who are drawing drinking water off the Mississippi River are being heard too, because it's the one Minnesota concept, and I think we need to really strive towards that. That's my comment. My question is, I'm a little naive. I'm curious about what a contested case hearing looks like and what that process would be, who's involved, how long it takes, and that sort of thing.
Ms. Wafel?
That's a procedure with the administrative law judge. Timing, you know, could be 60 to 90 days. I don't know whether or not we would need to develop, you know, something specific with respect to this. Again, would be happy to discuss language on that, but it's a specific procedure in administrative law. If you look at, for example, we've mentioned, thrown a lot of words out here, the total maximum daily load and PDS permits, a lot of those also have basically, you know, those two have to go to the EPA as well for approval, but with those, one of the ways that people, you know, with the TMDL, with the MPDS, one of the ways that people that are concerned about those and don't feel like their voices are being heard, they can bring a contested case hearing, and so it's heard by an administrative law judge who's an outside of, you know, independent person outside the agency. And, you know, our belief is that because the impaired waters list can also have an impact, we basically want to have those same sort of rights if we don't feel, I mean, I think Representative Fabian was correct when he said that this isn't, you know, people sitting in the back room dreaming up some concerns. These were, you know, based on real concerns that we had, you know, relative to processes that we don't feel like, you know, the comments and concerns are necessarily always addressed. And so what a contested case does is it gives a, you know, an outside body. And so it's something that, again, like I said, happens with MPDS permits, or it's allowed, is allowed with TMDL in other procedures. I guess the other thing I'd like to say on that, too, is that, you know, the question of cost, how much does this cost the agency? You know, our cities, they don't have oodles and oodles of money either. And so I don't think that this opens the floodgates to everything, you know, every time something, there's a disagreement, a contested case being brought. But the right has to be there, you know. And I think that cities use their resources cautiously, and they're not going to be driving down a road just because they have the right to, you know, but having those sort of rights out there are important, and I think that's partly, you know, what this bill is about, is being able to raise concerns and bring that transparency. You know, is it going to open the floodgates? I don't think so, because at least from a city perspective, they don't have the resources to open the floodgates. So
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my next question would be then, you know, the concern about a series of contested case hearings slowing down the process and getting expensive for everybody. Is it possible that since a person may petition the agency, so if I'm a multi-billionaire, can I just make about it and I chose to do this? What would stop me from making a dozen contested case hearings on a dozen impaired waters as a wealthy individual?
I apologize. You do have to have, you know, a threshold basis for bringing the contested case. So it's not just, I don't like this list, so I can do it. You know, that there is that threshold sort of basis of reasonableness which has to be there. So, you know what I'm saying? It's not like
you have standing.
You have to have standing. And there has to be, basically, to prove the standing, you have to have sort of a threshold objection of reasonableness. Plus, it would have to, you know, impact you and so forth. You'd have to have standing in that situation to bring it.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you for your patience, everybody. I just want to learn a little bit here. So I assume I would have standing as a citizen of Minnesota. And then can you help me understand that? How long does that take to determine whether my argument is reasonable and what that process looks like?
Excuse me, Ms. Wafer.
Yes, and I'm going to admit that I'm going to start hitting the barriers of my administrative law experience. The threshold determination, whether you can bring it or not, I mean, would be, it's up to the judge. It would be relatively quick, so.
Thank you.
How are we doing? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, sometimes around here, saying you're not being heard means not getting what you want. Or I guess not being heard, maybe you're muted sometimes, but.
Not in this committee.
Not in this committee, Mr. Chair.
Exactly.
And maybe I'm incorrect on this, Ms. Wefel, but hasn't this been litigated? Hasn't Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities challenged these things in court and lost? Or am I thinking about something else?
Ms. Wefel.
We have not raised the impaired waters lists in court.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for clarifying that. Mr. Chair, you mentioned some Duluth News Tribune story, which I don't have in front of me, and you mentioned 1,000 comments. Are those comments public? So you referenced there could be from Europe or from out of state. I mean, do we know who they are? Is that a public thing, or is that just a, I mean, are there wild Europeans making comment on that topic, or is that conjecture?
Well, based on my experience, and I've read public comments on an SNA project, for example, that was proposed by DNR north of Roseau, I read the public comments and people's names are on those. When we were doing some of the permitting things a couple of years back, you know, people were able to make comments and ask for, I don't remember exactly what it was, but the threshold was 25 petitioners. And those petitioners literally could be from anywhere in the world in order to be able to start some sort of an action. With regards to this article, and I have a copy of it here, Representative Hansen, I'd be happy to share it with you. With regards to this, public comments are public comments from my understanding. Now, there may be somebody in the room who's smarter than I am, but I don't think that you get to just anonymously submit public comments. I think that there is a threshold for identifying, and I'm seeing some heads nodding in the room, that you have to identify who you are and where you live. And I don't know that absolutely for sure.
And that was my point, Mr. Chair, that we don't know evidence that there are those comments on there until we look through that list. We don't know that.
Right. But my comment had to do with a statement issued by MPCA. I'm using their words, not mine. So.
And, Mr. Chair, back to the bill for a moment. Representative Swiezinski, you know, I hear, and I think it's a common theme of, and I've heard it more in the past, but I think it's kind of a traditional model here where legislators say we go off and work this out. That the lobbying community works with the agency and work it out and come back and then we'll vote on it. And, you know, I think in 2017 I would be okay with that if it's an open meeting. So it's not just one lobbying community, but the public could sit in on working out the process, because who speaks for the water? Whose job is it to protect the water? If you've got a lobbying community, they have a job to protect. They have their interests that they're representing. And so if there's one interest making the case to the agency, there should be the countering interest, or at least the public be able to be in there to see that. That's part of our role here. We tend to abdicate that role and defer it to something else to happen in the dark. And if we did that, if we delegated, Mr. Chair, to have that happen in the open, give them a room, have the public come in and let them work it out, I'd feel more confident in that. But that's not what happens. And that's not what happens often. So, Representative Swierczynski, would you be willing to convene a meeting with the agency and the interest that the public can come in to, quote, work this out? Mm. So anyone can walk in and see that, rather than just having the traditional model that happens at the Minnesota legislature of sending folks off to the back room to work it out and bring it forward and have us vote on it.
Representative Swierczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'll just piggyback. You know, I've, you know, yet to be addressed by the agency, and I think the coalition is dealing with the same issue. You know, I think what we're trying to address oftentimes is some very divergent lines of thinking. We talk about, you know, partisanship at the Capitol, and we talk about, you know, why don't people just get along? You know, oftentimes we reflect some of the thoughts and feelings and by the people that were elected. You know, I can't say 10 years ago what it was like at the local coffee shop, but today, oftentimes, you have a Republican table and you have a Democrat table at the local cafe on a Friday morning. I mean, sometimes that's reality. And sometimes they get along and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they buy each other coffee back and forth every other Friday. Yeah, I mean, if we could find a solution, you know, sometimes these things get hammered out at the last minute, and sometimes you have plenty of lead time to do it. You know, I'm always open to potentially convening that, you know, we'll see. I would just like to have a good conversation about it first, and then we can work it out. But, you know, these bills are important. You know, I don't think this bill lessens comments. I don't believe this lessens transparency. I believe it increases that, you know, on a very public note. But we do have concerns that aren't being met when it comes to the agency. Increasing that conversation, I think, is a good thing. But when it comes on a daily basis with a bill, I'm always willing to meet. And, you know, if that thing moves forward, maybe. But we'll see how this process works out between now and the end of session.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, was that Hoppy or was that?
Do I look like I'm panicking?
Representative Swierczynski. There's an amendment to our committee. We're going to ban the use of personal devices here.
Okay. Representative Swierczynski, if I think you heard the testimony here that most of our side isn't concerned about the 60 days as long as people know that that will cause a delay, you know, and that public comment period. You could probably have a unanimous bill out of here with that. It's that secondary clause that we're concerned about. But if you, I mean, we have the power to convene. And we have the power to convene in our districts, and we have the responsibility to be leaders to make sure we try to pull people together. So I'm willing to work with you on that from our side. If you want to, I'll bring the donuts, and we can have the public available and try to resolve issues. I think we have to try things differently to break up what isn't working amongst ourselves. And this may be one issue. There will probably be others, and there are going to be some where we don't agree. But I think we have to take these risks to try to work together rather than just relying on the votes of whoever's in charge.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Hanson's were much more to the point than mine. I was trying to figure out how we get folks to meet since there was a statement that there was no communication, there wasn't an ability. I'd still like to hear about that, but I'm going to withdraw that question and we can talk later. I just want to reinforce what Representative Hanson just said. And I think you usually bring very tasty donuts, so I really hope that it's it's something that Representative Swierczynski will help join you.
And to that point, I'll represent the people from Kitson County because I don't think they're going to drive 400 miles one way to come down for your public meeting. Representative Lewick, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A lot of what I wanted to hit had been kind of raised by a couple others, but there is one way I want to kind of circle back a little bit, is that the concern about how the science is used in, through this. And where I'm coming from is, in some ways I'm getting the feeling, whether it's right or wrong, the impression I'm receiving right now is that this is an opportunity where there may be a problem with the water that, say, mercury or chlorides or nitrates might be showing up at a certain level, and people are deciding, well, we'll argue about it and decide whether it's impaired or not, and decide we'll take it to courts. And the reality is those pharmaceuticals or nitrates are still existing in water at those levels that were determined. And it seems like this might be a process of saying, in some cases these waters will be determined as impaired depending who is complaining about it. In some cases it may not. And it just feels to me it's giving an opportunity for a set of standards to be a little different regardless of what is actually showing up there. And so some may say that the water may not be impaired when it's got the same level of contaminants as other waters that aren't impaired. And that's what I feel might possibly happen out of this.
Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a general comment on that contested case. You know, that's the words in their contested case hearing. We use administrative law judge process in a wide variety of items, and I'm not afraid of that. There's some pros and there's some cons, and I've been involved in that in a number of circumstances, both as a legislator representing my district and get my one set of comments in like everybody else, also at the local level. The pros are that what we have is we've got a third party that's taking in input and assigns, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but assigns kind of a quantitative, is this a fact or is this an opinion? And that's what they do, kind of a fact-finding process. They also look very carefully at exactly what the rules are that the agency that's involved has to operate by to make sure that the very process, the very matter in front of them is well within their authority. They're not overstepping it. You can show up in person and testify. You can testify in writing. You can by submitting a letter. You can testify through a website process. And at the end of that process, you have a third party that typically make some findings, and they may side on the some things that, you know, they may say, well, that's fine, the agency's correct there, and they may also say, but except here and here, the agency has either overstepped their boundaries or there's no facts to support that. I'm not one of those folks out there lobbying for more work for lawyers, but to me it strikes me as a very rational process that we should take when there's a significant disagreement out there on any particular issue. The one thing I will say, though, that make no mistake, that's going to add some time to the process. But these types of things, with those kind of major ramifications, if they reach that threshold, whatever that is, and that can be set by the legislature as to when a contested case hearing would be appropriate, it's better that we take the time and that be done right for those communities that are affected. So I find myself in an unusual circumstance, actually in favor of this contested hearing process, and that's kind of a brutal name for it, because it's more like binding arbitration, because when you give it to a third party in that circumstance, that administrative law judge, they make findings relative to what's before them. So I'm certainly not afraid of that. The only issue, obviously, is it would slow the process down, but if it's got to slow down to get it right, I've got no problem with that.
Thank you. Mr. Stark, give me your 30-second picture. I asked you to comment on the process for an extension. Just walk us through very quickly how long that takes and what it might cost.
Thank you. For our city, it's a little different than many cities, because I'm actively involved in this from the get-go. I'm in conversations with the agency. And for me to get that 30-day extension, it would just be a letter that I could write and request it. However, prior to working for the City of Red Wing, I worked as a consulting engineer, and I did work for smaller communities. And a lot of times I would be called in, you know, after one council meeting before the last one, and at that point no one's done anything. It's just, it's a difference in cities. But for the City of Red Wing, it would not take that much of an effort.
But for Badger, Minnesota, it would be a lot different.
It would be a little different.
Yep, thank you. Okay, next on the list here, we have, Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Lewick's comments, I just want to, apparently I need to clarify, I am a lawyer, and I'm glad that we share the trust in our judicial system. I'm glad to hear that. I just wanted to clarify that. My problem is not with the contested case hearing. I'm not afraid of that either. What I was pointing out is that we would potentially be having a contested case hearing both on the draft, on something that isn't final, and then you could end up having another hearing once the final list comes down, and I would just like to see us being proactive in working together during the comment period than going straight to a very reactive contested hearing. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lick.
Really quickly, yeah, absolutely. I agree with that, but I can think of, on rare occasions, but it happens, the whole thing is withdrawn, sent back to the agency, and told them you're way off base, start all over. If that's the circumstance, the sooner that that's identified, the better. Now, that's typically not what happens, and I may be referring to things that happen at the federal level that follow kind of a similar process. That, to me, if you've got a major disagreement, the earlier you get it out on the table and get it to a third party, the better. But again, yeah, you could theoretically, depending on the standard you set, at what hits the threshold for that petition to be acted upon, you could certainly add the possibility there of a couple of contested hearings on the way to who knows what. So I appreciate that. I understand.
Thank you. Next on the list, we have the Center for Environmental Advocacy. Ms. Lawton is here. And Friends of the Mississippi, and I apologize on the name. If you'd help me out, I'll try to get it right next time. Would you identify yourselves for the record, please, and who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony. Ms. Lawton first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members.
Good morning.
Members of the committee, my name is Betsy Lawton. I'm the Water Quality Associate at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Proceed.
MCEA is a 43-year-old environmental organization that specializes in law and policy. We're often involved in decisions about water quality issues throughout the state. And I do want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on the House File 766 as amended. Given the recent amendment, I'm going to keep my comments fairly brief because we do feel that many of the amendments have resolved some of our prior concerns with the bill as originally drafted. Certainly, as an organization that participates in decisions such as the impaired waters list and permitting decisions, we appreciate the need for a time period that's usable for everyone for comments. So we have no problem with the extended comment periods. That helps make an open, reliable, and meaningful public comment process. However, we do still think there are some things that need to be resolved. In particular, other parts of this bill seem to be a sort of a solution looking for a problem. So maybe they're just not necessary. And I think that's what some of the testimony thus far has said as well. And first, it seems as though there may be some misunderstanding of the impact of an impairment decision. The impaired waters list is a way for the state to figure out how to prioritize its resources to clean up dirty waters. First, they have to figure out which waters are dirty, and then they prioritize how to clean those waters up. However, the impairment decision should not have an impact on permits and the limits that are in those permits. If a water is polluted, someone who discharges pollution to that water body is going to have a limit, regardless of whether that water body is on the impaired waters list or not. I'm tangentially involved with the Delano, familiar with the Delano situation that was referenced earlier.
That facility would have a limit in this permit, regardless of whether or not it's listed on the impaired waters list, because we know that that water's already water body is already polluted. So something has to happen there, regardless of whether you're on the list or not. Second point, quickly, is that there appears to be some concern here that PCA is not considering recent water quality data. But if that data is presented to them during the public comment period, either by us or by anybody else who's concerned, or the permittee for that matter, PCA is obligated to review and consider that data. So is EPA when the impaired waters list gets to their doorstep, and they have to make a decision about whether that water body remains on the impaired waters list. So if the water quality has gotten better as a result of infrastructure and investment, PCA has to consider that. We hope that it's gotten good enough that we don't need a cleanup plan anymore, and that there's no need then to spend further state resources.
Ms. Lockwood, please, I want to interrupt you, and I apologize for doing this, but can you show me specifically in the bill where you what you are addressing here now in your comments?
Certainly. This would be lines, this is the amended version, lines 110 and 111 says that a valid basis for challenging an impairment decision would be an agency reliance on data that do not reflect recent significant infrastructure investments and documented pollutant reductions. That information, if presented to the agency during the public comment period, must be considered by the agency.
Thank you.
And that's what I was referencing there. In all, it seems as though the state resources are better spent rather than going through a contested case process. I'm a lawyer, too. I understand that those processes are sometimes necessary, but we do have an open public comment period, and if there is time for everyone to comment, I think the state resources are better used cleaning up waters than fighting over whether a water is dirty or not. Thank you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laylee Fadahi, and I represent Friends of the Mississippi River, a leading citizen-based organization that works to protect and enhance the Mississippi River and its watershed. Thank you for the opportunity today to speak against House File 766 as amended. And you know, the problem with this bill is that it encourages the very early use of an adversarial process when it's not only unnecessary but also bad policy. The bill essentially encourages people to preventatively challenge the MPCA over regulatory decisions that they haven't yet made and requirements that they haven't yet imposed and may very well not impose in the future. And the reason that they may not impose those requirements is that the draft listing is itself a mechanism for triggering collaboration between the agency and the regulated party about the specific circumstances of the water quality issue in question so that they can work together and come up with some sort of mutually agreeable outcome. There's no obligation that's imposed by a draft impairment listing, and even final classification as impaired doesn't necessarily bring with it requirements for particular TMDLs, RAPs, or any other specific cleanup requirements. So the bill really undermines mechanisms that are in place to encourage the agency to engage with regulated entities to develop cleanup plans that work for both parties. And, you know, in fact, it's not unusual for a body of water that appears on a draft list to be removed before the final list is published because the agency and the regulated entity have been able to resolve the issue. So, you know, one reason that it's bad policy to move into this adversarial process very early is that it undermines this ethos of collaboration between the agency and the regulated party, which I've heard, you know, quite a lot in this committee, that, you know, people want the agency to spend more time working with them rather than against them. This makes that much more difficult. Second, encouraging contested case hearings early in the process also comes with a very expensive price tag for both the challenging party and the MPCA. It makes it an upfront cost for the agency and for the regulated entity to pay for a challenge to a decision that is as yet unmade, rather than making it an expense that's only paid if and when a regulatory decision is made following considerable formal and informal opportunities for regulated entities and the agencies to agree as to an outcome. So rather than going to lawyers, this money could be better and more efficiently spent by the agency if it were used in the course of those deliberations and reaching a final designation, or used to provide technical assistance, for example, to get the water cleaned up so that it can be removed from the draft list and never put on the final list to begin with. Third, as a related matter, I worry that this bill may create a significant chilling effect on the MPCA carrying out its required responsibilities under both state law and under the Clean Water Act. If the agency fears that it'll have to go through lengthy and expensive adversarial proceedings each and every time it preliminarily considers whether a body of water should be considered impaired. And were this to be the case, my concern is that it would undermine the public transparency and accountability of the agency's process, because the agency would be more inclined to do its deliberation about what might be an impaired water behind closed doors rather than through a published impaired list. And then finally, I want to point out that there's...
50, please, okay.
This is the last point.
Yep.
There's nothing in the status quo that prevents a regulated entity from petitioning for a contested case hearing on a draft impairment listing right now without this law. Even without the authorization, that right already exists under the Administrative Procedures Act. And if I can figure that out, I'm pretty sure the lawyers for a lot of these regulated entities do. I think the reason that people don't do it is because I don't know why it is assumed that an ALJ is more likely to produce a favorable outcome for a regulated entity than a negotiated process with the MPCA. Certainly the CGMC has availed themselves amply of contested case hearings and been disappointed at the outcome pretty consistently. So I think this bill risks worsening the relative bargaining power of regulated entities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fatahi. Representative Swierczynski, closing comments on your bill?
I appreciate the robust conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill. And we look forward to, if possible, finding a mutually agreeable continuation with the agency and the coalition and cities across the state. You know, I think these issues are deep, and I think they need some resolution. This bill, I think, plays a part in that resolution, and we look forward to more conversations. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd appreciate this bill be considered for possible inclusion in your and Make Minnesota Great Again on this bill.
And with that, House File 766, as amended, is laid over. Members, any remaining issues before us?